All right, so we left last week in Camelot, right? We were talking in chapter 7 all the way through 10. We see the high point of David's reign. It never, ever, ever gets better in terms of spiritual temperature in Israel than this, okay? Solomon, as you know, is going to expand the land, so they will get more land underneath Solomon, but you're never going to see a king in a kingdom like this. Peace on all sides, the king being godly and gracious, and everything going as planned. The problem is we hit a wall in chapter 11. So for those of you guys that know what's coming, what is the down spiral of David? What is the brick wall that we get introduced to?
Bathsheba.
Okay, so stinking women. But we'll take a look at that this morning. We'll make some observations together, okay, and see kind of what happened with him. So I think it's worth noting, okay? We didn't dive into a ton of detail necessarily in chapter 10, but I think the highlight of kind of that season again in David's life is chapter 9, looking at Mephibosheth, and in my opinion, the greatest picture of grace, in your Old Testament at least, in your New Testament, I think to some degree as well, just because of the extended story and the lives that we kind of get to live through Mephibosheth and David and seeing that really powerful story of a crippled young man that now gets to sit at the master's table as a son, okay? Chapter 10 is kind of the rest of the battle. There is one kind of funny portion in here. Funny to us, probably not to the people that it happened to, but it's worth noting just because it's funny. When David's on the rampage and killing some fools in chapter 10, he gets to the Ammonites, okay? And that, remember the guy that he tries to extend kindness to, and he sends in people to, in verse 2, he says, "I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash." Nahash was a dude that apparently David had developed a decent relationship with. Nahash saw this offer of kindness as a threat, and basically David coming to spy out the land. Verse 3, his servants tell him, "Has David not sent servants in order to search the city, to spy it out and to overthrow it?" So verse 4, Hanan does something that's dirty. Read what this guy does in verse 4 to David's men that came in to do good, but he thought they came in to do bad.
"Hanan took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut their garments in the middle."
So he shaves them half, not like half this way, half this way. So full beard and nothing, okay? And then full garment and then on one side and nothing, and then sends them home. Why would that be so offensive? Like, it's obviously like awkward, but why in this culture would that be so offensive? Think Levitical law in terms of beards. Yeah, you're not supposed to cut it. So what did that say? Like, you cut half of it. I mean, you look like a clown. So what are they forced to do? They got to cut the other half, right? I mean, they're bringing shame upon themselves, and then they've got to basically re-shame themselves by shaving the rest. David is gracious to these guys, and he sticks them in, where's the text? He sticks them in a city to allow them their beards to grow back. Where's that? Thank you. Okay? And he'll stay in Jericho's where your beards grow and then return. So he doesn't make them serve public, humiliation because of that. Okay? So, and then David basically comes back and whoops them all. He's like, "How dare you?" Okay? So that's the end of chapter 10. So that's verses 6 through 19. David spanks them. Okay? So that's the Mike Sladen quick version of that. All right? So battles won, peace on all sides, grace extended, amazing picture of David as king, and then comes chapter 11. Okay, so here's what I'd like to do. Let's just read, okay? And I want you guys to teach, okay? I want you to tell me what's happening, what you see, if all these good, bad, and indifferent. So somebody pick up in 11:1, and let's just make some good old-fashioned, sorry, PJ, hope you guys all figured that out. Okay, if not, you're done. 11:1, let's pick up there and let's just start making some observations together. So somebody read that and then let's apply or observe.
"In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem."
All right, observations. Spring, okay, which means what? What does the text say? You go to battle, okay? Where's David? Right? Why? Okay, maybe. You got Joab, who's like automatic victory, right? So you brought a pretty solid guy in Joab, okay? David stays home. There's your half-full version, right? How old's David at this point? Like 50. Okay, so he's been on the throne how long?
20 years,
thank you. Well done, Mitchell. Mitch knows math, okay? Got on the throne, he was 30. He's fought a lot of battles. He's 50, okay? Now, I'm 37. I already feel like a half step behind most of you guys. I'm tired, my legs hurt, right? Like, it's getting old sucks, okay? And I don't feel like I did when I was 16. I can't imagine at 50 thinking, really? Another battle. So there's a part of this where you go, okay, David, I get it. You're older, right? There's not a lot of 50-year-olds that you're going to recruit for your, right? You're like, no, I'll get the 20-something, you know, young guy that thinks he's invisible and indestructible guy. Okay, so he's 50 years old. Okay, not lulled. O-L-D. Okay. Oh, gosh. I think older than this. Yeah. So you see some guys. Caleb was a freak, though. So just, he's an exception. Yeah, he and Phineas can, yeah, they die with spears in their hands. So, okay. So he's got Joab. He sends his people out to battle. Okay. So what else? Anything in verse 1 that you guys see? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. After 20 years of doing battle with David, I mean, that's someone would look at that on a good day and say, man, that's good delegation, right? Joab's leading your battles, but you're at home, and okay. So, all right, let's go verse 2.
It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, and he saw from a roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful.
Okay, so verse 2. Make some observations for me there. He's what? Hold on, Sonny, you go first.
Sorry. He was napping in the afternoon.
Napping in the afternoon. Okay, yeah, this is probably not a college student situation where he's rolling out of the rack at like 3 and just getting up. He's probably taking a nap. Okay, so very normal deal. You would sleep often on the top of your house, right? Cool breeze. You guys are basically, you're going to stand in or very near the spot where David would have stood when this happened, okay? Jerusalem is a city built on a hill. Where would the king's palace be in relation to everything else? On the top, right? Because he can overlook his city. So he rolls out, and he literally is overlooking his entire city, okay? It would have been a very normal deal for a king to come out and look around his city, okay? So innocent enough in terms of what he's doing initially, okay? So he's napping, okay?
They do everything at the top of the
year. It seems like it, right? Well, it makes a lot of sense, right? Breezes blow through there. You can nap, you know, hobbies, what have you. So bathroom, apparently, yeah. So I'm hoping those were separate to some degree, but yeah. So apparently we'll find out the next verse. Was it this one or the next one? There's also going to be bathing. We're in the bathing, okay? So there's bathing. Okay, so yeah, we're in the bathing. All right, so, okay, keep going. Jeremy, what were you saying?
That when he woke up from his nap and went outside to look around, he wasn't intentionally looking for sin.
I think it's good to know, right? He walked into this one, right? This is one of those you're like, oh, hi, you know, okay? So I think it's good to remember, okay? David found himself in a situation that he did not bring upon himself, but lo and behold, he's here, okay? And now he's got to decide what to do with that situation, okay? So, how do you want to say that? Starts innocent? Doesn't end that way. Okay? What else? Good. Mm-hmm.
That she's bathing, mm-hmm. And notices that she's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life. This is going to sound a lot like Adam and Eve a long time ago, right? So, okay. So he sees this, he observes this. Okay, tell me about Bathsheba. Make some observations. What's she doing?
Bathing.
Okay, what type of culture is this? Modest or immodest? Extremely modest. Okay, so what she was doing wasn't necessarily out of place. Okay, bathing on your roof was not odd. Okay, now she probably wasn't just fully exposed. There was probably, I would assume, a covering of some sorts. And, you know, so I don't know how they bathe on their roofs. I know, you know, we went to Thailand and I had to take a bath in a river. And, you know, you're trying to figure out how to bathe yourself with what they call the sarong that you put on yourself. It's like a large skirt, you know, and you basically, that's how you bathe in the river. And, you know, people would walk by and there's me and like three other dudes. Like, and you're, you know, and you got your dial bar soap and you're waving, you know, and it's awkward. So, but we were appropriately dressed given the occasion, right? So I don't know what exactly that would have looked like, but she was certainly exposed. Mm-hmm. Right. So there may have been, right? Okay. Ladies, any other observations with her?
Why is she doing it in the middle of the
day? Yeah. Okay. So it's an odd time, right? So it's evening. Maybe that means something. I don't know. Paint the half empty version for me. Ladies, is it possible? Maybe. I have met, say it as gently as I can, I think there are plenty of gals at times that are completely unaware of externals or dress and maybe don't understand how that affects a guy. And I've also met gals that are fully aware of it and know what they're doing, and know how to get the response that they're looking for, okay? So I don't know with Bathsheba, okay? I know on a half-empty day, David, maybe this isn't the first time this has happened. Maybe David has seen her before. Maybe he's looking forward to this. Maybe she knows that she's been seen before by David and is, okay? I don't know, but the text is certainly open to that. So it's an interesting situation, at the very least, okay? So it's no bueno, okay? Now, David, verse 2, makes an observation, sees this woman who is very beautiful in appearance, and the text almost seems like this may have been the first time. I don't know. It's hard to make any concrete statements about that. What in verse 2 should David's response be? What would we like to see here? He turns around and walks away, okay? I've heard it said before, the first looks free. Oop, okay. You know, and you go, didn't mean for that one to happen, and there we are, and here I am, and it's time to walk away, right? What does David do? Verse 3. He inquires. He takes the next step, and this is where he's going to get in trouble, right? He has time to think about it and processes that, and he says, man, I'm the king, and the situation is just so set that what else is David? Because of verse 1. Where are all his men? Gone. He is alone. Okay? Alone. Always a scary place to be. Whether it's physically, whether it's having guys in your life, or seriously, I'm going to like wrap myself into some mummy and you guys are going to have to undo me one of these days. Stuck. David's in a difficult spot because of that. Okay? So now he's put himself there. He's alone and he's the accountability, the Joabs, the whoever else that's in his life normally is not there, okay? So, verse 3, okay, make some observations there. Or read it. Have we read that one yet? Read it all, por favor.
David sent and inquired about the woman, and the woman said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of
Uriah? I'm sorry, I have no idea what that guy's name is. Thank you. Yeah. That guy's unimportant. Sorry, dude. Okay, so sends a servant. Hey, servant, go get this gal. Okay, so you're seeing the full extent of 1 John 2:16, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, boastful pride of life. He sees. He now moves to the next step where he's inquiring, and he wants her, for obvious reasons, to come to the palace. Okay, what's this unnamed servant do? Yeah, that's kind of an odd deal. Daughter of so-and-so would have been a normal, like, oh, this is Gianna, daughter of Bob. You know, sorry, what's your dad's name? Gary. I was close. Good. It's one syllable. Gary. No, that's two. Anyway, okay, so that would have been normal. But to mention the fact that she's married, what is the servant saying? Why would he have done that? Now, if you're a servant of David, like, how much room do you have to rebuke the king? Probably not a lot if you want to keep your job. So he's gently putting that out there, right? It's a reminder. Isn't that so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so, wife of Uriah the Hittite? Okay? So there's an out option, right? So David, in case he didn't know before, like, that would have been any better if she was just some single unmarried gal, the ante gets upped here, and he's told, no, this is a married woman, okay? Married to who? Who's Uriah? One of his mighty men, okay? David has an army, okay, who is at battle right now. Uriah is one of those guys that's at battle, okay? And he's not just some random honyak. He is one of David's most, like, he's like ninja. He's army ranger. He is one of the elite forces, okay? David has 30 dudes that he talks about as bad mamma jammas, and he is one of them, okay? So he knows Uriah. He trusts him. This is not some, like, fringe dude that he's like, who? So when he heard that name, he's like, got it, okay? So that would have set off bells and whistles, okay? What else? What else do you guys see? Any other observations in 1 through 3 before we move on? Okay. All right, verse 4, keep going.
So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanliness. Then she returned to her house.
Okay, so in one verse we see her coming in, the act, purification, and her going home. So again, it's like a battle. It's like you get two verses on David and Goliath actually fighting, the rest of the chapter is on everything else. One verse, okay. Observe for me in verse 4. What do you guys see? No, after. Okay. What does that tell you about Bathsheba? Why would she be purifying herself? Right. She knew it was wrong, so she could worship. So what type of gal do we assume that she is? Godly. Okay. So this isn't some, like, hard-hearted Philistine woman or whatever who doesn't care. She is a godly, she's a woman that at least cares about the Levitical law enough to say this is the right thing to do in this situation. She purifies herself, so she's in some sense godly, okay? Obviously makes a, isn't the best decision, all right? But for what it's worth, she purifies herself. She cares about that. What else do you guys notice? Okay, so you see a second initiation from David. Ladies, make some observations for me on Bathsheba in that verse.
She's willing.
She's totally willing. Thank you, Stephanie. What does that tell you? This wasn't some forced situation, right? That's why I kind of read into this a little bit and go, I wonder if 11:1 was the first time this happened, okay? If she wasn't trying to maybe seduce him. Now, I want to be careful about who we place blame on, okay? I think Bathsheba had a hand in this. I think David is the one we probably need to focus on. But I don't think she's completely innocent in what happened here, okay? It takes two, okay? And had she said, I'm married. Now, that's obviously a very, it's a little bit more difficult thing to do when the king says such and so, and she probably felt a little bit more, it's a harder situation maybe to get out of than, you know, to rebuke a king, but nonetheless, okay, she's in that situation and does nothing, and she's completely willing, and verse 4 just happens, okay, so unfortunately. What else? Right. Yeah, it's got. Yeah. This is a one-night stand. I don't know any way to say it, but she comes and they do what they do, and then she goes home, right? It's David's getting needs met, as is she, and when they're done, they're done. Okay, so this isn't some heartfelt, yeah, I mean, this is, it's sin, right? It's not, okay, it's, and it's over, okay? And then the only words that Bathsheba speaks, only recorded words we have of her, verse 5. That's no bueno, right? So that took probably, I would assume, for a gal to figure out she's pregnant. What are we talking about? Weeks, if not months, you know, you miss a period, and oh goodness, and let me go get an EPT pregnancy test. Oh wait, they don't have that, you know, so it's taking her probably a while to figure this out, and she gets news to David. What's the one thing that David doesn't want to hear right now? Verse 5, right? Because your eye's gone. No one saw this go down. There's no evidence. You gonna be quiet? I'm gonna be quiet. Okay, we're good. Now what happens? Oh crap. Now there's evidence. And in 9 months, there's gonna be some serious evidence, right? So he's in a sticky situation. So what should we be hoping to see in verse 6? What would be our hope?
Confession.
Yeah, confession, right? I'm pregnant. Okay. And David confessed, okay? Problem is now he started something and now the sin which he thought would be, I don't know, easily hideable or what have you, he it's now lost control. And now he's lied, and now he's got to build another lie upon that lie to cover his first lie. And welcome to lying. That's what it does, okay? We're in the midst of life with our six-year-old right now trying to help her understand that that's what it does. And she has a bent towards that, which is amazing at six, that she has a bent towards not being honest, and we're trying to teach her the ramifications of that, hopefully, so that she doesn't end up in lies that ruin her life, and, you know, now it's just about homework, right? So, verse 6, keep going. What's David doing? Why does he want Uriah? Yeah, hey, come home! Woohoo! You've been on the battlefield a long time with all those stinky, hairy guys. Hey, there's your wife. Hey, here's some wine. Hey, I'll leave you guys alone now, right? That's exactly what David's thinking, okay? Verse 7, Uriah comes to him. Hey, how's the war? What's going on? David says in verse 8, go down to your house, wash your feet, hang out with your wife. I'll give you a little present, okay? And Uriah's like, oh, okay. Verse 9, this is his response. Tell me about Uriah. What type of guy is this? He's a stud. He really is. He sleeps at on the steps of the palace. He won't go. And remember, his house is an eye shot of David's kingdom. It's a quarter mile away. You know, it's right there. My wife's right there. She has no idea I'm home. Hey, honey, I'm home. Here's a bottle of vino. You know. He will not do it, okay? David asks in verse 10, Uriah finds out he doesn't go down. He says, how come you have, why did you not go down to your house? Verse 11, here's Uriah's answer.
Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. So I then go to my house, eat and drink, and
rely on
my wife. As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing.
What a response. That is a... Look, Joab, the Ark, my boys, they're sleeping outside in a tent fighting battles. How awful would it be for me to go down and have any sense of pleasure with my wife? I won't do it. So David says, okay, so let's up the ante. Here comes Lie. You can just see the snowballing. Okay, verse 12, stay here today. Tomorrow I'll let you go, and I'll send you back to the battlefield is basically what he's saying. Verse 13, here's David's next plan. Surely he won't have enough self-control to go hang out with his wife when he's good and drunk, right? Sends him out in the evening to go lie down with his wife. That's his hope. But Uriah, verse 10, did not go down to his house. So what a contrast of character, right? What a slap in the face to David. Okay. Now watch this. This is horrific. Read 14 and 15.
Uriah
So David writes a letter to Joab, tells him what to do with Uriah. Who's going to deliver that letter to Joab? Uriah. So he's got his death sentence in his hand. He trusts his character that much where he seals the letter and says, take that to Joab. Doesn't open it. You know, Joab is going to read it. Does exactly what he says. Joab is very suspicious, by the way, of what's happened. He's like, you sent for him to come home. Now you're sending him back and you're having him killed. Like, Joab is, I think Joab, because of his relationship with David, their history, and obviously their cousins, he knows David well enough to know something's fishy here, okay? So the long and short of it is they do that. They send Uriah out, put him in the hardest part of the battle. Joab withdraws, does exactly what David asked him to do. He's killed. Joab sends a messenger back to David and reports the news, and Uriah is dead, and Joab is very suspicious of why this happened. He hasn't figured it out yet, but he knows something's goofy, okay? 26 and 27, read this.
When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord.
Okay, so what does David do? What is his final, why does he do that in 26 and 27? What's the purpose? This isn't noble kinsman redeemer stepping in, providing offspring for, you know, this woman who's lost her husband in battle. Why does David do this?
To make it look like it was a noble act.
Okay.
To make it appear that way to the rest of his kingdom that he's taking care of Uriah.
Okay.
Mighty men, and Uriah dies, so I'm going to take care of his wife.
Why does he have to do this? She's pregnant. So this thing has to happen, bam, 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 fast, right? She comes in, oh, it's his wife. Oh, look, she has a baby 9 months later, okay? Nobody knows the difference. At this point, nobody knows. It's covered. It's done, okay? Joab is suspicious, but everything's worked out the way David wanted to. Now, it took him 4 or 5 more lies built upon lies to get here, but at this point, David thinks, man, I'm in the clear, right? By the way, chapter 12, the confrontation that is coming with Nathan, is probably 2 to 3 years later after the act. Okay, so think about that. David has sat on this for 2 to 3 years, okay? Nothing's happened. He's escaped consequences. Nothing's going to happen is probably his deal, okay? The problem is the end of verse 27. The thing that David had done was evil on the side of the Lord, okay? God knows, and he's leading Israel. And we've seen before when leaders blow it and are unrepentant, God is quick to say, listen, that's not okay, and your consequences are going to be heavy, okay? And we obviously know the rest of the story, okay? So note to self, okay? What do you guys see? As you step back from that chapter and now begin just to apply, what do you see? What do you feel? What are the lessons for us as young men and women, some of us younger than others? What are the lessons for us? Absolutely. Great lesson, right? It started what David thought was small. I guarantee you, in that first look in bringing her into the kingdom, did he ever think that he was going to have a man murdered, cover up this stuff? That was never, ever in David's. But, man, it's not... It's not what you think when you're in the midst of sin. It's deceiving, right? So it snowballs. What else?
It shows how you need to really have a sense of self-control. And that if you don't, it's
a thing. Yeah. Yeah. David chooses in a moment to not listen to the spirit, listen to the flesh, and it all goes awry, okay? Again, how old is David? 50, okay? He's in the fall... winter of his life, okay? He's walked with God for a long time. He's walked with God longer than most of us have been alive. And when does he blow it? At the end. Remember that. When did Moses blow it? At the end. You see a theme, okay? We were out of town with the Bells this last weekend and hanging out, and Brad and I have a long, long relationship, which is fun. I don't have a lot of friends that have that type of history where I've known for 18 or 20 years. And we were talking about, like, wishes in life or whatever. And he said, man, at the end of the day, I just want to be faithful over the long haul. Like, that's my greatest hope. Because 20 and 25 and Brad's now 40, you know, you just realize, man, it's a long, slow, arduous journey to the finish line. And at any point, I could do something stupid and flush, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of walking with God in a heartbeat. It's just, it's easy to do. So something to remember, guys. It's one thing when you think, oh, I can handle it and I'm young and I'm invincible. And David kind of rested on his laurels and got a little cocky and saw a situation, and the situation was just painted as such that, boy, it got scary. Okay, so as a guy that's 37 and thinking about that in life, man, that's a tall feat to walk with God for decades, right? And the guys that I respect the most, Chuck Swindoll, right, one of the pastors in Texas that I kind of studied under, was the president of the seminary that I went to. The guy's 70 whatever, you know, and is probably close to 80 at this point, and has just been getting after it for 60 years, loving his wife. And he had some, you know, hiccups with her early on in their marriage where they were had problems, but, I mean, he got his life on course. And here's a guy that's been just doing ministry for 50 plus years, loves God, and you don't see those moral hiccups in his life. So no doubt he's got issues, but he's walked with God enough and made sure to, yeah, what else? Beyond what we can bear.
So that was very interesting. That right before it happened, there was an exit.
Yep. Yep.
I've seen that in my own life. That he does come.
Yep. Was it 1 Corinthians 10:13? Is that the verse? It talks about that. No temptation will seize you except that which is common to man. God is faithful and provides an out, or something like that. There's my jacked up Mike Sladen version. But you're right. And it's good to remember. There's an out. When we look for it, there's an out. Okay. And God allowed David to. He painted that situation, and he allowed him to experience it, and gave David an out. Okay. What else do you guys see?
Kind of bounce off what Evan said. Not only is it needed and necessary to have self-control, but have people around you that can keep you accountable.
Yeah. And you see that David, it seems like he had those, but not here. Right. So yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's good. Ladies, how about from you? What does a lady take away from this chapter? You sound like my middle daughter. How's your day? Good. What do you see? I think it's great. This is a great environment to be able to see what's in the mind of the opposite sex, and what, like, gals, what do you observe? What do you see that we don't see because we're dudes?
I think it just shows that regardless of, like, obviously David's a king, and you don't want to, like, just be someone that's in higher authority, but you just have to, like, hold to your morals and not act in that.
Right. That's got to be very, very difficult. That's a hard situation. I have a sense of empathy for her. Go, to rebuke a king and say, that's not right. Morally, that's not right. Like, so, yeah.
I think just being aware of, like, kind of like what you said with the nurse, you have to be really aware of your situation and what you're doing, because you don't know how it's going to come back to you.
Yeah. My wife will frequently ask me before we leave, is this outfit okay? Is there anything about this that would be, just because she knows I think like a guy and other guys think like me. Is there anything, you know, and there's times I'm like, no, it's great. And there's times I'm like, no, save that for another occasion, right? And it's great. And I she's sensitive enough to that to say, listen, I'm not looking for accolades from others. I don't need that. But I want to look nice, but I want to make sure that's appropriate. Okay. So, so ladies, your dress matters. Okay. And things that you may not think through matter. Okay. Guys are wired. We are hardwired different. Guys are visual, period. all of us are. Okay, so ladies, you can do all of us a huge favor by dressing in a way that says, I recognize that and I want to help, you know, my brothers. That doesn't make you responsible, but there is certainly, we deal with that nonstop, right? Driving from wherever to wherever, you're going to see billboards and life and people and non-Christians that don't, you know, it's out there. And, you know, we have to take responsibility for that, but y'all can help a ton, okay? So I always appreciate women that are aware of that, and you can tell in their dress that they are thoughtful of, boy, I want to dress in a way that honors God and doesn't cause someone to unnecessarily stumble if I can avoid it, okay? That doesn't mean you need to wear like a full-length robe and whatever. You can still look nice, but yet be conservative in your dress, okay? But just something to think through, because I think a lot of women just don't realize, like they don't think about, huh, I wonder how this is going to affect a guy. And like, oh, and some women, I think, unfortunately do, and they choose to put it on because of the way they know it's going to affect the guy, okay? So wherever you fall on that spectrum, be aware, okay? Kimas.
I think it probably made it easier for her too, because maybe like he's gone all the time, so she maybe felt lonely.
Yeah.
It's not easier, but just maybe like,
it's hard, right? She's in a difficult spot. Man's gone, right? That's for sure. Yeah. You can see a reason why that situation would have been more difficult than, you know, if your eye had an 8-to-5 and he was coming home and, right? It's just not the case. That's difficult. Cool. All right. So, good lessons learned, okay? The kingdom will never, ever get restored to the degree that it does at this moment. David's going to get forgiven. We're going to watch chapter 12 as to how all that gets exposed. God takes care of him. There are consequences to his sin, okay? And part of that is now David is going to hit kind of a low spot. God is never going to give him the peace that he had before. He's never going to have the amount of land that he had before. God is gracious to him, and he still gets the promise of the Davidic covenant, a son that's coming in Solomon that's going to sit on the throne that ultimately ends with Jesus. All that is still true, but David still has to pay the piper, okay? And God forgives, but does not always remove us from the consequences of our sin, okay? And in this case, David's going to feel that in a hard way, okay? So, chapter 12, verse 1, 2 to 3 years later, let's watch what happens. Okay, so here's Nathan, okay, prophet. He's a trusted guy with David. What does he do? What's he doing with David?
He's very clever in how he's approaching, not just strictly.
Yeah. And what means does he use specifically? He tells him a story. Everybody likes stories, right? So he tells him the story. Hey, there are two men in a city, okay? Now, connect the dots for me, okay? Two men in a city, one rich, one poor. Who are the two men? David and Uriah, okay? The rich man had a great many flocks and herds. Who's the rich man? David. The poor man had one little ewe lamb. Who's the poor man? Uriah. Who's the ewe lamb? Bathsheba, okay? Which he nourished and brought up and nourished. It grew, was tender to him and his children. It would eat. Okay, so you're seeing this relationship develop between Uriah and Bathsheba, okay? Verse 4, now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock and his bread to prepare the wayfarer who would come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who would come to him. Who's the traveler? Verse 4. Yeah, it's interesting. He's the only character in the story that doesn't have a one-for-one, like, okay, you're him, you're him, you're him. The traveler is, ooh, David's desires, sin. Sin enters the picture. What are you going to do, David? Okay, so more than likely, that's probably the best way to look at it. You've got this guy that has need, okay? And that's kind of how that's painted, okay? Notice David's reaction, verse 5.
And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and
deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing, and because he had no pity.
Okay, walk me through David's response. He what?
He obviously doesn't
get it. Yeah, he hasn't figured it out yet. Okay, so Nathan goes, and he goes, yep, gotcha, right? I got you right where I want you, okay? How does David respond specifically?
I feel for him, though, because I see that when I see sin, and then my mind filters like to other side, justice. I see him as like my roommates. Like, I see something like done wrong, I'm like, cool. And I just see clearly. But then when it comes to your own personal sin, because there's a line of justifications that have to happen. Mm-hmm. Yep. Clearly, because you just lie to yourself. And then, so I kind of see this is what most of us would do.
Okay, so let's talk about that. What is justice in this situation? What would the law tell us is required of a man who stole another man's sheep? You restore the sheep, and potentially what else? Four or fivefold. You remember Zacchaeus? If I stolen from you, I will restore to you what I took and pay you back 4 to 5 times what was required. Okay? What does David say? What's that?
He says the same thing where to restore and restore the land and then.
Yep. But what does he also say in verse 5? He should be killed. Is that the appropriate response? Why does David blow a gasket here? What you think about this? This is important. I want you guys to, this is a counseling nugget that someone told me and I went, that's brilliant. Why is David so angry at this particular sin? Because it's his own sin. So he does what? Overreacts, compensates. Why? To distance himself, right? To feel better about that. So if he can overreact and show how awful that is, then surely that's not a part of David's life. Okay, I've noticed in certain situations, not in all, but when someone blows a gasket and overreacts to a situation, you go, why? Why would you feel that strongly about that issue? And sometimes it's because someone is grappling with that same thing and they're trying to distance themselves from that issue in their own lives, okay? Not always the case, but I find it interesting that David does not judge in this situation rightly. A godly king who knows the law should say, this is what must be done, okay? And to be impartial, to be unemotional about it, and to be with, you know, in a healthy way and say, okay, this is what happened, Nathan, then this is what should go down. That person should restore the ewe lamb. And that they should now restore 4 or 5 times. That's what the Levitical law says, ensure that it happens. That would have been the appropriate biblical response. David goes way beyond that, okay? And Nathan, exactly what he expected to happen, does. Verse 7, here's where it all comes to a head.
Nathan said to David, you are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul, and I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife.
Ouch. So I know everything that's happening. Okay, so 4 powerful words. You are the man. You're the thief. You're the guy that stole the ewe lamb. I mean, you can almost see the finger in David's chest from Nathan. Okay, what type of guy is Nathan, by the way? Dude, he is not scared. Like, you talk about a persister, that's a persister. I don't care what you think about me. This is wrong. I mean, Nathan just isn't scared to say, David, this is how it is. Throw me out of your kingdom, do whatever you want. They've got a history together, and he thumps his chest a little bit and says, this is on you. It's painful, the words that come out of Nathan's mouth. God says, I've done all this for you, and had you wanted more, all you had to do was ask. I would have blessed you even more. By the way, at this point, how many wives does David have? A ton. Enough to, you would think, that would satisfy him in this area. Is that the case? No. How many did Solomon have? 1,000. Like, right? We saw that last weekend at church. Was he satisfied in this area? No. Okay. It's a good reminder. More is not better. More does not satisfy. More just, that's sin, right? It's not, what do you need? 2 wives? 5 wives? 6 wives? 10? 50? 100? 1,000? Okay, that'll be okay. Solomon needed 1,001. David needed 9. I don't know, but it's not, it's never something that ends with just one more, okay? So note the self. Consequences now are coming. What does David's, what does God say, verse 10? What does that mean? Yeah, there's war coming, okay? And specifically, war with who? Your son, Absalom, okay? In your house, okay? Verse 11, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. See, also Absalom. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Ooh. Indeed, you did this thing secretly, but I will do this thing before all of Israel under the sun. David, here come the consequences, okay? It was private for you. It's going to be public as it gets exposed, okay? Here is what I think makes David a godly man. Verse 13.
And David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord hath also taken away your sin. You shall not die.
Okay, 13. Make some observations for me there. He repents. Yeah. Yep. I've sinned. Against who? The Lord. Uriah? Certainly, but more so, God. This is a sin against God. Okay? And he says that. Okay? What is Nathan's response? More specifically, theologically, what is his response? You've been forgiven, and the Lord has taken away your sin. Okay? And that's good to remember in the midst of this. He's forgiven, and God has restored that relationship that fast. Okay? He confesses, he just acknowledges to God what God already knows to be true, and the relationship is back. Okay? And you're going to see that David's not going to, he's going to struggle with that. He's going to struggle with this aspect of forgiveness, and okay, just like we do in our own muck that we have to wrestle with, David is going to wrestle with, am I really forgiven? I don't feel forgiven. I need to, you know, I need to have penance, or I need to do whatever to really, you know, and God says that's not how this works, but we often feel that way, okay? You're forgiven, verse 13, you're not going to die. However, you have been given occasion, you've given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, okay? So God's going to get laughed at and mocked as a result of this. The child also, end of verse 14, that is born to you shall surely die. That's exactly what happens. David and Bathsheba have a kid. Kid dies. God is gracious and brings David another kid. And it's a tough story, kind of how all this goes down. And ultimately, as a result of this, has a son named Solomon with Bathsheba. Okay, so this is a tough deal, but that's how it ends. Okay, there's some good theological nuggets in this. David finds out that his kid is going to die, and he goes into mourning, and he freaks out to the point where the people are like, "Dude, he's not eating. He's going to die. He looks horrible," and the kid dies while David's fasting and praying and asking God to. And they're like, "Dude, if we tell him, this is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. David's going to freak, and he's literally going to die." So nobody wants to tell him that his child's died. So they finally go tell him. David gets up, takes a shower, eats dinner, and they're like, "What?" And they say, "Hey, like, while we were, you know, we told you this news, before the kid dies, you're praying and weeping, whatever. Now we tell you that the kid's dead, you're fine. Like, what gives?" And David makes a very interesting response to his guys, okay? Look at verse 22. Read 22 and 23. So David's like, "Hey, I thought maybe God would be gracious and relent. He didn't. So should I keep fasting? Like, it's over. He's dead. It is what it is. Can I bring him back again? No, he's dead. Okay? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. Okay? Reading between the lines right there, what is David's assumption? What does that mean? I will go to him, but he will not return to me. You kind of get the impression that David feels like he's going to see him again. Not now. He can't bring him to David, but David will go be with him. Okay? One of the things that, if you haven't yet, you will one day, I assure you, as you guys get older and get married and start having kids, you're going to come across a situation where somebody has lost a child in a very, very unfortunate tragedy or what have you, and they're going to ask the question, what happens to my kid? They weren't at the age of accountability. They didn't have the cognitive ability to even accept Christ. They were in this situation. The kid was brand new, right? So there's no ability for, you know, in our dispensation, in our time, for there to be a relationship with Christ because the kid isn't at that. What happens to that kid? Scripture does not paint a very clear answer. So seeing also blocks of truth, right? It's not, we don't know, okay? This seems to hint at the fact that David feels that there will be a day where he will see that kid again. Now, he didn't say this trying to pen theology. I don't think that was David's intent. And that's not necessarily how we should read this text, but I think it does give a hint or at least a possibility of God taking care of children who aren't, for whatever reason, able to come to know him mentally or emotionally or what have you. Does that make sense? So you'll have to wrestle with that on your own terms, but you know, as we've sat in the ashes with people and friends that have been through the situation, it's hard, but yet there's here in one other spot in Scripture that we'll look at that seems to indicate that could be a possibility, okay? So you're going to want to know where you stand on that issue before you enter into that living room, okay, and know what to say to a mom and a dad who have lost a kid, okay? And you don't want to give them false hope, but you also want to give room in this room, okay? So in the next 20 years, I guarantee you, you guys will deal with that issue to some degree, unfortunately. I tend to lean towards the fact that that kid was, in our terms, saved, and that God is gracious to those that aren't there, okay? What do you do with mentally disabled people that don't have the cognitive ability to wrap their minds around that, whether they're 3 or 30 and they can't get there, like they can't mentally understand the gospel and respond to it? What do you do with that, you know? And Scripture is very clear that there's one way, and it's Christ, and, you know, so that I don't, there's a slippery slope in that to universalism or exceptions or whatever, and I don't think that's what, clearly not what I'm trying to say, but I think that there's hope there. So in those situations, you want to give people biblical hope and speak where you can, and I can't be dogmatic about that, but I say, man, it sure seems that that's the case. Goodbye. So for what it's worth, that's kind of how I've handled it. So, and it's a hard issue. So, okay. It's in Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. We'll get there. I can't remember where it is right now. It's one of the Kings. So again, 24 and 25, Solomon's born from Bathsheba, Solomon or Jedediah, okay, so he's obviously going to be the next king, and that is the piece of the story that continues from there. So there's a glimmer of hope and a picture of forgiveness even from God in that situation, okay? So tough deal, and again, you wonder what David's kingdom would have looked like and the extent of what he could have been had this not taken place, okay? But there you go, all right? So now here is where it all gets ugly, okay? 13, you guys remember Judah and Tamar back in Genesis? This is a similar situation, okay? This is a hard chapter. So 13:1, somebody pick up there. Okay, now, so Absalom and Tamar are blood sisters, okay? Same mom. Amnon is from a different mom, one of David's other wives, and has a half-sister that he loves, okay, or has the hots for, or whatever, okay? It's a weird situation. Welcome to the oddness of having eight wives and kids with all of those wives, and then all living together. And now this dude's got the hots for his half-sister. So it's a bad day, okay? So welcome to the complications of the table that David has set for himself, okay? So Amnon was, it says, frustrated because of his sister, sexually frustrated, because he made himself ill, for she was a virgin and seemed hard for Amnon to do anything to her. So he has this passionate, lustful feelings for her, but can't express those, okay? So Amnon is, this is a bad situation, okay? Amnon's got a chump friend named Jonadab who is filthy McNasty, and he says, oh, great, here's what we're going to do. And he basically lays out this plan, okay? And he says, hey, you're going to fake like you're sick. You're going to have, you're going to ask David when you're sick for Tamar to basically come serve you while you're sick in bed, okay? And that's the plan that they lay out, okay? David says in verse 7, yep, Tamar, go do that. David has no idea, okay? He's completely unaware of the situation, okay? Partly because he's dealing with his own issues, okay? He's, one of the things that we're going to see in David is he's a little bit absent as a dad, okay? He's kind of mentally not there a lot, and he's got a lot of issues to deal with, I would imagine, in his kingdom. Okay, it's hard enough to be a king, much less to be dealing with your own insecurities and your own sin and your own problems, and he just doesn't see this coming, okay? So, this situation unplays. Verse 9, she took the pan and dish and brought them before him, and he refused to eat, and Amnon said, have everyone go out from me. Okay, so all these people in the room, while she's trying to feed him, he says, everybody leave, for obvious reasons. And he says, hey, why don't you take that food to me in the bedroom and I'll eat from your hand. You're like, oh boy. Okay. Verse 11, she brought them to him to eat. He took her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister. Okay. Exactly what you think that means is what it means. He wants to have sex with her right now. 12, notice her response.
Answered him, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel.
Okay, so she makes it very clear what this is. No, this is disgraceful. This is rape. Such things are not done in Israel. Okay, so she is crystal clear. This is not a mutual agreed upon situation. Okay, so she stands up for herself. Okay, verse, what's that? Yeah, you're like, good, yeah, good for you. Okay, and then she attempts to give him an out. Okay, and I think this is a, it's what we'd all do in this situation. Like, let me figure out any way to get out of the situation. 13, as for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? As for you, you will be like one of the fools in Israel. So you're going to be an idiot. I'm going to be an idiot. This is going to end bad. Now, therefore, please speak with the king, for he will not withhold you from me. Like, hey, there's another way to get this done. Just go ask David because he won't withhold you. So I don't think she means that. I think she's like, any way to get out of the situation, I will paint to you, you know, and hopefully that's what's going to take place. So she's trying every method possible to extract herself from the situation, okay? They're alone, they're in a bedroom, there's nobody there. She's in a bad spot, and she's obviously with the male who it now, verse 14 says, is stronger than her. He violated her and lay with her, okay? So verse 14, Amnon rapes Tamar, okay? Amnon now, verse 15, hated her with a very great hatred. So again, this isn't love, this is lust. He says to her at the end of verse 15, get up, go away. So he's now feeling his own guilt and shame and wants her to leave. And she says to him, no, because of this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you have done to me. Yet he would not listen to her. So he has her basically removed from her presence. She goes into mourning. Tamar, verse 19, put on ashes on her head and tore her long sleeve garment. And then in verse 20, look who finds out about this. Read that.
Then her brother, Absalom, said to her, has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. Here, he is your brother. Do not take this to heart. So Tamar lived, a desolate woman, in her brother Absalom's house.
Now, if you're the full-blood brother of your sister who just got raped by your stepbrother, sorry, that's a lot of whatever, how does Absalom feel right now towards Amnon? Angry, okay? And they're not full brothers. And his full sister just got raped. So what do you think is coming next? Vengeance, justice, okay? Now, verse 21, read this. Does David find out? Yes. How does he feel? Angry. What does he do? Read verse 22. But Absalom. Whoa. Where's the part where David responds and deals with this injustice that's happened? What does David do? Nothing. Why? Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on with David, okay? He's still wrestling with the guilt of his own sin, okay? And he's fully aware of that. So he doesn't have the moral authority to speak into this, okay? Some of it is justified because David blew it. And some of it, I think a good portion of it's not. He needed to step up and do something. So now what is Absalom going to be forced to do? You got a young, passionate man who's got more brawn than brains, and he's going to respond exactly how you think he's going to respond. What do you think is going to happen? Someone's going to die, right? Absalom is going to kill Amnon. If David doesn't step in and execute justice in the way that this should go down, and by the way, rape in Israel, what's the punishment for that? Death. It's death, okay? So the proper, that's what should happen. Now, how hard is that for David to do? Could you do that? Could you send your own son to be murdered? Right or wrong, agree with what they did or not. How hard is that as a father? I can't imagine that situation. That would be incredibly painful to choose, in one sense, one son over another son, okay? Amnon, firstborn son, okay? Absalom, on down the line, okay? David is in an impossible situation right now, okay? He knows what's right to do, but boy, I don't fault him. I don't know. I don't think I can handle that situation any differently. That has got to be impossible. So he should do something, but boy, there's no good something. So David just feels bad and shuts his mouth, okay? This plays out. Absalom finds a way to get Amnon alone, shearing sheep out in the middle of nowhere, puts his men in verse 28 on him and says, get him drunk. When he's hammered, kill him. And it's exactly what happens, okay? David gets the report that Absalom has killed Amnon. Let's see. Amnon alone is dead because in verse 32, because of the intent of Absalom, this thing has been determined since the day that he violated his sister Tamar. So he gets the report, hey, David, you knew this was coming. You did nothing. Your son's dead. And he finds out, okay? Absalom now flees, okay? He knows, man, I've just killed a man. David's not going to be happy, so he doesn't really know what to do. He basically runs north to the east side of the Sea of Galilee and hangs out with a guy there, and we find out he stays in this town called Geshur, or the king of Geshur, or town is Geshur. He stays with a king there, and apparently it's there's some relationship there. I forget how the family tree works, but he's basically got family up there. Notice how long he's gone, verse 38. Three years, okay? Here's the issue now. How's David feel? Read 39.
And the spirit of the king wanted to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead.
Okay, so David's in this really weird spot in that he knows that, in a sense, Amnon's death was right because that's what was the punishment for the crime. He wants to reach out for Absalom, but he can't. Like, he can't emotionally get there, okay? So what's David's hang-up specifically? What can he do with Absalom? This is important because David has still got an issue way back from chapter 11 that he hasn't dealt with. What did Absalom do? Killed another. What did David do? Killed another man. So David can't forgive Absalom because David hasn't forgiven David. You guys see the tension there. God is doing this for a reason. This isn't on accident, okay? What's odd enough, there's going to be two heroes to the story, one of whom is Joab, okay? The other, you'll find out here in a second. See also chapter 14. So he's there 3 years. Absalom is up by the Sea of Galilee. estranged from David. David wants to bring him back, but he can't get over the hump of forgiveness that it's going to take to get there, because David is still wallowing in his own sin. 3 years later, 4 years later, how far is this, you know, after chapter 11? I don't know, but it's at least 3 years, okay? Now, watch what Joab does. This is my tension with Joab. There's days you go, man, buddy, you're awesome. I love you. And then there's days you go, oh, buddy, you're a loose cannon. And I every year I'm like, oh, I want to love you, but I can't. And he's just an odd guy, okay? 14:1, read that. What does that mean? What does Joab see in David? He sees his grief. He knows that he loves his son. And what is Joab wanting to do now? He wants them to reconcile. So Joab, good for you. So he's trying to get them to reconcile. Now, Joab is also shrewd like Nathan is. Okay, he's wise enough to realize that if I go have this conversation with David, it's not going to go the way I want it to. So he's going to do something. Watch what he does. Verse 2.
And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth.
So what does Joab do? He's going to manipulate David, okay? Manipulate's a strong word, but it's fair. He's going to do what Nathan did. He's going to put David in a story, okay? And he's using this woman who David will have sympathy for, unlike he would for Joab, and she is now going to paint a story from the words from the mouth of Joab, okay? So, okay, and it's odd. Oftentimes when we see women, if not, maybe not all, is probably an unfair word, the women become the heroes of the story, okay? And here's another one that, if this gal had a name, you would want to name your kids after, okay? Wise woman from Tekoa probably isn't a good first name, but this gal's wonderful, okay? And Joab is the one, he's holding the marionette strings, okay? She comes to David, verse 4, prostrates herself on the ground and says to the king, I have an issue. David says to her in verse 5, what is your trouble? And she says this in verse 5, truly I am a widow, for my husband is dead. Your maidservant had two sons. From the two of them struggling, but the two of them were struggling in the field, and there was no one to separate them. One struck the other and was killed. Okay, so they get in a fist fight in a field, and no one's there. One son kills the other son. Now behold, verse 7, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, hand over the other one, the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Is that biblical? Yes, okay. You kill somebody, we're going to take your life in return, and we're all good, okay? Thus, they will extinguish my coal, which is left, so leave me neither husband, nor name, nor remnant on the face of the earth. The problem with that is, I have no husband, and that's my last son. I'm done as a woman, okay? So, she's in a really odd situation, okay? Do you see what Joab's doing? He's drawing David in. Here's the situation that just happens to mirror the situation, David, that you're in, okay? You've got two sons, one killed the other, the alive son is estranged, and they want him dead. What do we do? Okay? Verse 8, this is David's response.
And the king said to the woman, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you.
Okay, interpret that. What does David tell her to do? Go home. Why? I have no idea what to do. I can't handle the situation, right? This is way, way, way too close to home. So David says, go home and I'll give orders concerning you, meaning I'll deal with this later, like never. That's his answer, okay? So do you see where he's at? Like he can't figure out how to wrap his mind around this. Verse 9, she pushes. Keep reading. Okay, so she makes this plea, please answer me, Let my son not be destroyed. David's response, end of verse 11.
As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground.
So what's David's answer? Should this son die? No. It's an exception to the rule. Should he die? Yeah. Levitical law? Yeah. David says, in this situation, that wouldn't be right. Okay? You're going to be without a son. You have no husband. Your line's going to be extinguished. The answer is not to do according to the word of the law, but to the spirit of the law. Your son's life should be spared. So what did David just say in that moment? What has he said? What does that mean?
Absalom should live.
Different situation, but same situation. Okay, one son's killed another son. In this situation, the son should live. You see what Joab's done? He's made David make a statement about this situation, not knowing that he was making a statement about this situation. Okay, brilliant. Okay, Joab thought through this. Please, verse 12, let your maidservant speak a word to the king. The woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that he does not bring back his banished one." What does she do? She pulls a Nathan and thumps him in the chest and says, "You're guilty. You're saying one thing and you're living out another. You believe this to be true, but you will not forgive your son. You are doing the people an injustice because you won't bring Absalom home." Okay? What is God doing? Step back for a second. And what just happened? What's going on? Paint this for me. Why would God make David make that statement? Okay. It's a piece of it. He's making David deal with this issue and forgive himself, okay? Who, by the way, is in the place of God in this story? Think about it. David. David is having to show forgiveness to this son who's murdered somebody, right? And he says, "I forgive you, and I'm not going to kill you." So paint that picture with David in his life. Why is God putting him in the God character in this story? David, I've forgiven you. I love you. It's over. I forgave you in that moment. I'm making you live this out through my eyes so that you'll see you're forgiven. And you're going to say what I would have said in that situation. Because though you blew it, you're still a godly king and you're making the right decision. I'm going to make you live this out. Okay? God, Joab, the woman from Tekoa, this is a brilliant situation. God makes David live this out through his own eyes. Okay? I don't know if you guys have ever been in those situations where God's put you in one of those weird deals where you realize, like, I just feel like maybe a glimpse of how God must feel in a moment, and you go, holy cow, right? Think about the birth of my children when they, you know, they come out and you hold them for the first time and you feel nothing but just utter delight and, like, I could never not love you. And then you think, wow, like, what must it be like for God to adopt me and to feel this way about me, and you just get like a glimpse of how God must feel in a situation, and then you recognize how he feels is so much greater, but you just have a, like, maybe an understanding as a father for the first time. I've had a couple of those in life where when you kind of get them and they almost feel eerie, you're like, oh wow, that's, you know, my fingers are tingling. You just don't want to touch it. So it's just powerful that God made him live this, okay? Now, David recognizes that, but he's still not going to be able to get all the way there, okay? But God, at least theologically, has helped him understand, buddy, we're good. And if we're good, you need to be okay with yourself, and you need to move on, and you need to forgive yourself, okay? So she kind of keeps saying this. They walk through this story. Verse 18, David is pretty discerning as well. He says to the woman, "Please do not hide anything from me that I'm about to say to you." And the woman said, "Speak." Verse 19, is this at the hand of Joab, basically? So David recognizes, did Joab put you up to this? And she says, yeah. And David's wise enough to figure this out, okay? King says now to Joab in verse 21, I will surely do this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom. So David says, go get Absalom, okay? Bring him back, okay? Verse 23, Joab arose, went to get Absalom from Geshur. However, verse 24, read that. So David brings him back, but what happens? He won't see him, right? He brings him back into the town to basically say, look, I'm not going to kill you, but what am I also not going to do? Yeah, I'm not going to restore that relationship. Now, son to dad, what is that son yearning for right now? A relationship with his dad. Specifically, what does he need from dad? I love you. I forgive you. We're okay. Give me a hug. We're cool. You know, he needs, from a son's perspective, David has the ability to do something for his son that no one else can do. He just needs to make things right with Absalom. And you're going to see, this is a great example of like teenager rebellion. You're going to see a need in Absalom that is legitimate, that he needs from his dad. He's not going to get it, so he's going to respond one of two ways. Okay, you've heard of the two type of kids that both have the same issue. They both need love and acceptance from dad. And one goes and gets straight A's and lives the perfect life, hoping that their performance will give them the approval of their parents or dad or mom or whatever. That's one strand. That's how some of us respond. The other is, fine, then I'll go live crazy. I'll go live, you know, off the rocker morally and do whatever in hopes that I'll find love and acceptance somewhere else. The root issue is the exact same. They're trying to find love and approval, and one has realized, I'm not going to get it from dad, so I'll get it somewhere else, or maybe I'll please my parents by getting straight A's, being a, you know, a great athlete, or whatever it may be, and they go off that way, okay? But the root issue is the same, okay? So Absalom's going to go off the rocker. Verse 28, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. How painful would that have been? Just every day you're hoping, Dad, just invite me to dinner. Just, can we go have coffee? Can we just sit down? Can you just tell me that you love me and you've forgiven me? That's all I need from you, okay? So you guys remember that when you sit in the seat of David one day and you've got kids that they just need you. They need forgiveness. They need love. And that's all Absalom wants, okay? Absalom now sends for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent a second time, but would not come to him. So Absalom is now going to Joab saying, please tell my dad I want to see him, and he won't. Okay, here's his response, verse 30.
Therefore he said to his servants, see, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire.
You think that got Joab's attention? Here's your income for the year. Torched, right? He just sets his field on fire. Joab arose, came to Absalom and said, dude, what are you doing? Now, I would imagine that's not a guy you want to screw with, right? Joab, not high on the, hello, do you know who this guy is? So he's a tough guy. So behold, I sent for you saying, come here and send me to the king. Why have you come to Geshur? So he's mad. In 32, now therefore, let me see the king's face. If there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death. Meaning, I just want to see my dad. If I'm guilty, let me die. If I'm not guilty, let me move on. But I cannot stay in this tweener land anymore. Okay? So when Joab came to the king, he told him, he called for Absalom. Then he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So finally, at the end of 33, there is a reuniting. The problem is, it's too little, it's too late, it's contrived, it's done at the hand of Joab. It's not, in Absalom's mind at least, heartfelt or real. So Absalom has been permanently wounded because of his dad's neglect, and whether it's right or wrong, or whether David was legitimate or not in his response to him, Absalom is really pained by this. So he now goes off the rocker in 15 and following, okay? Let's start on that, and then we'll finish it tomorrow, okay? So Absalom does this. Verse 2, read that.
Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate, and when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, then every man who has any suit or case could come to me and I would give him justice."
What is he doing, 2 through 4? Where is Absalom standing right now? City gate. And what's he doing? He's stepping in. He's politicking right now. He's standing in the gate. "Oh, hey, what's your need? Oh, what's this? Oh, yeah. My dad's too busy. Like, he can't even answer that." You know what? And that's a legitimate need. If I were king, I would be able to handle that case. And I'd be able to execute justice, and I'd be able to tell you what was wrong. And, "Oh, I would meet your needs. I'd take care of you." You see what he's doing? He's kissing babies and shaking hands, and that's what Absalom's doing. What does he have in mind? "I'm going to be the next king," okay? And you can see now where he's just set his mind to it. The relationship with dad is severed. No bueno, and he basically is making a play for the throne. Verse 6, "So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." So he is a good-looking, smart, very wise and shrewd dude, and he has now taken the hearts away of the people. Okay, it came about at the end of 7, verse 4 years. Absalom raises up, basically gathers a bunch of servants and everybody and says, "We're going to have a coup. We're going to kick David out of the land." And that was his plan. Verse 13, "Messengers came to David saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel with Absalom.'" Like, oh no, now what do we do? David finds out a coup is about to occur. And what do we do? Okay. Verse 14, David says, "Arise, flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity upon us and strike us with the edge of the sword." So now David's in a tough spot. Do you fight for your kingdom that took you 20 years to get? Or do you just let it go and walk away? Because if you fight for it, who do you have to fight? Your son. And he doesn't want any part of that. Okay, so David's in a tough spot, and we'll see how he handles that tomorrow. Okay, but Absalom is now in full-on revolt mode. David is having to make a decision as to what he can do, and he's just going to basically pack up bags and leave in a hurry.
14:27.
Yep.
Did Absalom name his daughter after his sister?
Yep. Yep. So you see how special that relationship would have been. He named his daughter after his sister that was raped. Right? So, okay. Good. Okay, friends. Enjoy your Thursday. We will see you in Dominicana.